Hello and welcome. My name is John August, and this episode 636 of Script Notes, a podcast about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. Today on the show, what's with all the whispering in movies? Is it a deliberate narrative choice or just a fad? We'll discuss voice and volume. We'll also look at what you can learn from reading early drafts, the threat of TikTok and YouTube, and answering some listener questions. Helping us out with all of this is returning guest host, Pamela Ribbon. Welcome back.
Hi. Woo. Yay. Hi. Thanks. Woo. I don't normally get a woo on. Oh, hello.
Woos are very, very nice. We had you on this summer and you were absolutely a phenomenal guest. But since that time, I got to see your movie, Nimona, which was fantastic.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's a lot of people's movies. But yes,
it's a lot of people's movies.
It's a lot of people's movies. But yes, I'm so glad you got to see it. That is a miracle.
Yeah. So it's a very long process. So I do want to talk some about the history of that and sort of how it moved around and finally got made. But I also want to talk about you got to go to the Academy Awards with that. And I thought for the bonus segment, we would just talk about going to the Academy Awards and what it's like to go to the Academy Awards.
Totally. That's one of my favorite things to talk about. We'll do it.
Not only were you there, you showed up in the background of so many famous people's shots, which I love.
Yes. Most unexpected.
Very nice. Before we get started with that, Drew, we have some follow-up.
We do. So Foxy wrote in some follow-up about vetting in last week's episode. She wrote, I was so stoked about the discussion of vetting in 635 because it's something I've been wondering ever since Me Too. You guys gave great advice, but I had more questions. With Me Too, most of the behavior being called out was not on set. It was behind closed doors. Most abuse functions that way. The abuser often wants to keep it a secret so that they can keep their good reputation intact, hence whisper networks. Now, I'm a woman, but I've never been tapped into any whisper network in any area of my life. And I would never want to hire someone who is abusing someone behind closed doors at home. How do you vet for this? Because cutting ties and showing there's professional and reputational consequences for this behavior is super important. But how do you find out in the first place if they're keeping it secret?
And Foxy's question here reminds me of something we really should have gotten into in the last discussion, is that we were talking about vetting as an employer, but you're also vetting as an employee. You're wondering, like, is this person I'm going to work for, are they a good person or not a good person? And that can be just as important. Pamela, I'm curious whether you have any thoughts about this. Like, how do you check to see whether that person you're going to be working with, either you're going to hire them or you're going to be working for them, how do you start to check about a person?
Well, I mean, often it's not really all that whispered, I find. So there's that. And then you kind of have to believe women. You have to believe what you hear, even if that's inconvenient for you and what you'd like to do. You can check with your reps and you can check with people that you know who've worked with these people or for these people before. And, you know, I find usually people will start with that because they don't want you getting into a situation that they could avoid. They could help you avoid, you know.
I had an incident just this past week where we're talking about a person and there was a passing comment about, like, oh, yeah, there's some sort of Me Too thing. But, and when I heard that, like, Me Too, but, I'm like, oh my, that was a signal to me that, like, I do need to investigate this more. And so asking around additional people and getting some confirmation that, like, some folks were uncomfortable with this person. And that's good information to have. It really influences what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Either way, so if you're not sort of tapped into certain official whisper networks, I think it's good advice to check to see whether that person is working with the same people again and again, which is generally a good sign that they want people around, unless they're working with the same people again and again because those people are helping to cover up some behavior. And when you do ask about a person, there's this line where, like, sometimes they're not willing to report the behavior they saw, but they're willing to tell you sort of in confidence that, like, this wasn't great.
I think of that as the whisper network. Like, I don't know about a network either, just to help Foxy feel like you're in the network. Like, if you're talking to people and they're talking to you, that's kind of how it is. It's not like we have I guess if there's a database, I don't know about it. But I would also say this is a good time to bring up hiresurvivorshollywood.org.
Tell me about that. I've never heard of this.
This is a organization that was created by Sarah Ann Mass. I don't know. It might be Massey, who was one of the Weinstein silence breakers. Mm-hmm. It is to address the issue of career retaliation against those who've been sexually violated and those who've shared those details publicly. So one of the ways that you can help make sure that you're not hiring an abuser is to hire a survivor who spoke out, who might be suffering some of the things that happen to you, even though they tell you won't happen to you and can't happen to you, and even HR says can't happen to you if you talk about what has happened. And I think it's important that we are able to say, you know, you can come forward and you can talk and you are not just protected. You are going to continue to have your career, which is one of the first things they threaten you with, right?
Yeah. It's important to remember that in Hollywood, where you tend to go from job to job to job to job to job, having a break where you've not been working is a problem. And so if you haven't been working for 6 months, it's increasingly harder to get that next job. And so I could totally see someone who was speaking up and speaking out and didn't get that next gig or that gig after that, it can be hard to sort of keep momentum in your job, in your career.
Yeah, you can get labeled as, you know, a troublemaker or someone who encourages people to talk and speak out. And so, you know, that's the opposite of the whisper network, right? So we don't have to whisper anymore. So I do feel like that's part of vetting is if you're even having to wonder, like, is it worth it for this person? Then maybe there's another person out there who is worth it.
Let's go from whisper networks to literal whispering in movies. So this is something that came up this past week with people's observations that in the movie Dune 2, there's just a lot of whispering and characters are whispering in situations where you don't really wonder whether they'd be whispering in real life. So let's play a little clip here. This is Timothée Chalamet's character and Zendaya's character talking. It's a little intimate scene. Let's play a bit of this.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. We don't have that here. Here, we're equal. Men and women alike. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Oh, Muad'Dib, Uso. Maybe you could be Fremen. Maybe I'll show you the way.
All right. So this is leading up to their first kiss. I actually really like this scene. I love Timothée Chalamet saying, I'd like to be equal to you. If you are just listening to this at home and don't have the visual here, you might think like, okay, they're in bed someplace. There's people around. They're whispering for some reason. But no, they are on the top of a sand dune with no one else around at all. And yet they're whispering.
That's right. Cause that's love, baby.
That's love. Love is. So yeah. So let's talk about that. So it is intimate. And so there is an intimacy created by the whispering. This scene didn't bug me when I watched it in the theater. It's only when someone pointed out, like, it's really weird that they're whispering here that it stands out.
I just think of Timothée Chalamet as just, he is whisper. Like that, if you could make a human out of the word whisper. Well, he's just whispering in doorways and leaning in and wants to be equal with you. Like, come on. Don't make him volume. I'm leaning all the way in. Same with Zendaya. She's so much beauty and talent. You're like, just give it to me on level 2. It's all I can take.
Yeah. Full chest Zendaya. I couldn't take it at this moment.
We'd explode.
Yeah. So we have not read the script for Dune 2. So we don't know whether in the scene description, it's talking about the fact that they're whispering. I doubt it is. It was a choice made by the actors and director in staging the scene to do it this way. It's a very deliberate choice. But let's talk about, as screenwriters, situations where we might want to have our characters whispering, when it would make sense, when we would actually put in a script and when it would just sort of feel kind of natural along the way.
Yeah.
So obviously the main reason characters whisper is so that other people around them don't hear it. And that feels really natural. And so when you see that in a movie, you get it. You're whispering so people can't hear. So sometimes that's an aside. Sometimes that is so the guards, you know, 10 feet away are not hearing that. Mm-hmm. Other examples. Pamela, what are you thinking of?
Well, I don't even think of this as whispering what they're doing, but in a movie this loud, this is considered whisper, right? So that's part of it too, is you want to whisper so that you can have the opposite effect of what the rest of the film is going or the rest of the scene. I think, you know, comedic tension whispers are my favorite whispers. You know, where it's like, I can't even speak to it. Because then you really get to like hiss at each other. Comedic whispering is the best.
It's really good. I think about sort of like not waking the baby. And so like the parent arguments are happening so that they don't wake the baby. That there's comedy there too, where like you're shouting and whispering at the same time. That could be a fun moment. In the scene we just watched, like it's an intimate moment. I don't know in real life if they would really be whispering, but it does bring us in closer to them. And that's honestly sometimes the job of a whisperer is to invite us into that close up so we're really close in. Weirdly, because the camera does get close on people's faces, if people are talking at full voice, it can feel a little strange. It can feel a little shouty.
Yeah, I'm thinking about times also in a script, you might want someone to whisper to get all of the attention. You're whispering on purpose. It's very, I suppose that's, I'm just now thinking of my dad. It's very parental. Like the angrier he got, the quieter he would get, so that you were like, oh boy.
Yeah. Don't worry about dad when he's shouting. Worry when he's whispering.
Yes.
Yeah. People whisper to themselves, or sometimes they'll whisper to a character who they know can't hear them. So an example is in Rear Window. He sees that the guy's coming back and he's whispering, get out of there. Like, so he knows he can't, he's saying what he wishes he could say to the actual person. And there's no way to actually say that. So you also see that when people are talking to, they're watching something on a screen or, you know, a monitor, and they're trying to say, ah, and there's no way to communicate it. Weirdly, whispering is a thing people do in those situations.
Yeah, but that's to let us, the audience, know that he knows he can't talk to them.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's a question like, would you do that in real life, or is that just a movie convention that you're vocalizing what you know you can't say to the real person?
Yeah.
Weakness, like, so a person who's on their deathbed, we're sort of used to the whispering there. Confessions. So
I'm sorry, I'm still laughing that you have weakness equated with deathbed confessions.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking weakness, like, it's too heavy. I think we need to take some of the weights. But you were like, it's buried under the backyard flower bed. You're like, what a weak man.
What a weak man. I mean to separate weakness and confessions. And so weakness, like, you know, a person who is physically frail, it makes sense that they can't sort of put their full voice behind things. Confessions, I will say, is a separate thing because, like, I see dead people. Mm-hmm. You're letting somebody in on a secret. And, like, sometimes you whisper secrets even if there's no real reason to whisper.
Particularly creepy secrets.
Whispering is creepy at times.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm here for you. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
We were looking through some examples of sort of famous whispers. Of course, Rosebud, the horror. Scar leans in to say, I killed Mufasa. And then, of course, my precious. And that's, of course, a character who is basically entirely a whisper. It's just like his actual voice quality is what we would consider a whisper.
I wrote one in Nimona, which is, he's perfect. Like, after this, like, you know, all these reasons that this man's a terrible, the villain number one, everybody's after him. Nobody will ever love him again. And she's looking at all of this news info and she says, he's perfect. And I went to look at the script to see, like, what did I say? And I just put it in italics. And then I was like, oh, I don't even remember how it's done in the end. And this is pretty amazing that you just open it up in Netflix and I just hit a button and it went right to the line. I was like, no, that's fresh in there. But she kind of growls it. Chloe kind of growls, like, he's perfect.
Well, the whisper growl is a thing, too. It's, you know, Bane's voice in Batman, really sort of Batman's voice in Christopher Nolan's Batman, is a whisper growl. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm speaking softly, but with a weird masculine intensity.
Yes, the 30 Rock quote is the talking like this contest, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So in the case of Nimona, you probably put that line in italics, and italics makes sense for that. It stands out. Other choice would be to, you know, put the parenthetical above that to sort of indicate that, okay, this, did you say whispering? Like, just that it's not at full voice. There's a thing there. But in the case, again, where characters are whispering lines that they wouldn't necessarily need to whisper, that can be an on-the-set choice. That can be a choice the actors are making, the director is making. And as long as everyone's on the same page, it can work. Mm-hmm. Kind of related is sort of the issue of, on the podcast a lot recently, we've been talking about word choices. And last week we were talking about characters whose native language is not English and how you mark that in scripts and how you make choices that sort of indicate that English is not their native language as you're writing those characters. Fundy baby voice came up. And this is our friend Chris sort of pointed this out. And it was something I had not been aware of until you see these examples like, oh, I totally get this. This is an example of what's called Fundy baby voice.
Okay. To be a school teacher, and I love that, but I just felt burdened for so many people, and I felt the calling to go back to school to become a Christian counselor.
So this is Mike Johnson's wife. It's a voice. It's a choice. It's a very specific way of speaking. And if you had a character who was speaking this way, you would need to indicate that in the script because it really fundamentally changes our instinct about how those lines sound and are delivered. Have you experienced this in your real life or in scripts yet?
Well, I was just thinking, like, this is such a church voice where, like, yeah, you're like, it's learned, it's a choice. I'm like, I think it might be ingrained. Like, it, you may learn this growing up of keep sweet and obey. Like, this is the voice that you're supposed to use to be, as you've got written here, childlike, sweet, submissive, and honey. But this voice, to me, is, I mean, I understand it's fundamentalist, but it doesn't take much to turn it into, you know, you're in the South with the same voice.
Yeah. Yeah. As a counterexample, you look at like Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos and sort of the way she was deliberately pitching her voice lower, you know, sort of pulling down to a different register to give her authority that she felt like she couldn't have in her normal voice. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if this is sort of just kind of how we fundamentally kind of police women's voices, the way we also police bodies. It's just like, there's no right way for a woman to speak.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I have done the Theranos, as we call this act, in rooms when I've recognized that the sound of my regular voice giving ideas isn't reaching ears anymore, and it's like getting tuned out, and then I just start saying it like this, and it definitely works. Definitely works.
Like, and are people aware that you're doing it?
Well, only, or is it still- yes, because I tell them. That's who I am, where I'm like, do you like it better when I say it like this? And, you know, and they'll be like, I do. And I'm like, I know you do. We're going to look into this. But this voice very much works. She's not the only one who knows. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take much. You just say it like this. When I look at videos of me in high school, as I did a bunch for my year of dicks, my voice is lower back then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I think I was hanging around boys all the time. And that was just where my voice hung out. It's very Jeanine Garofalo, probably, right? Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was the style at the time.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that because, you know, obviously, whether it's Christian Fundy voice or the sort of Theranos voice you're doing, yeah, you're pulling your voice examples based on the community around you and sort of what seems to be working and how do you fit in with the community around you. So Mike Johnson's wife, she's probably doing that voice because that is the community that she's in, and that feels like the right choice. And if she were to make a different choice, there would be consequences for her doing that within her community. So that's the choice that she's making. You were referencing My Year of Dicks, which is, of course, the incredible original series and then sort of done as a film you did and got the Oscar nomination for. So as you're watching those videos, do you remember deliberately choosing to lower your voice, or that was just a thing that happened?
I don't know that I definitely chose to lower my voice. I think I probably always have. I mean, I still have a bit of a lower voice, and it's only getting more so. But I definitely know that there was an affect of, I think maybe it just happens in your teens of, you know, when you get your first official hormonal whatevers.
Yeah.
And you just sort of lean back in that sound of detachment that stayed that way. I don't know that I would ever write in a script how someone should do their voice, because isn't that what the actor is, you know, bringing to the table? Unless it was she was masking her voice for some reason and doing an impression or something like that. I don't know that I would say she's got Fundy voice, even if I were writing a character who is a fundamentalist.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like sometimes, you know, I need to be able to hear the character's voice in my head. Mm-hmm. And if I'm hearing it in a way that is not going to actually translate on the page without me sort of calling it out, that feels important. I mean, obviously, if some other character is referencing it, you're going to need to put it there.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a musicality to sort of how these people are doing it that is different. And, you know, Elizabeth Holmes, not only is she pushing it lower, she's also going more monotone. And that changes, you know, the same words are going to come across very differently given that. So, you know, you're going to make some different, you know, literal word choices to sort of fit that pattern and how it's going to fit.
Word choices is true. I think I would maybe blend some words and italicize some words to get that musicality of the reader can hear what it says. Yeah. But I don't know that I would even talk about their pitch or something like that. Mm. But you're right. If someone else is, well, she's definitely a low talker, isn't she? Like, there you go. You've got it. Yeah.
Yeah. Going back to the Seinfeld reference, thinking back to you said you pitched your voice lower. I'm sure there was some moment at which I kind of internally recognized that I had gay voice and changed. And so that I pitched lower. I sort of made choices to sound less gay. But I don't remember when that was. I don't have good examples of me on tape sort of showing when my voice shifted. I'd love to see some forensics on that, but I just don't think that material exists to just figure out, was it in fifth grade or seventh grade that I did make that shift, because my register is much lower than it probably should be for my overall size and shape. And at some point, that was just where I landed.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bunch of tiny recalculations, probably more than like, oh, the summer I turned this voice, you know?
Yeah. This conversation is reminding me of a movie that I really, really loved, Lake Bell's In a World. Mm-hmm. I want her to make many more movies. And I really liked this, but I was a little troubled by one sort of thread of this. So if you haven't seen the movie, it's about a woman who wants to be like the narrator, announcer for film. So in a world where blah, 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 and sort of how that business is so male dominated. But it's her conversations with other women that become a bit of an issue and sort of come through at the end. So let's take a listen to one clip here.
Hey, watch it. That is so rude.
Oh my God. Okay, excuse me. I'm so sorry. I just want to give you my card. I'm not a vocal coach anymore, but I would make an exception for you because you sound like a squeaky toy. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but I mean, like, I think you're better than that. You know what I mean? And I think we're all better than that. It's good for the species. You know what I mean? But there's also a Jamba Juice like 2 blocks away from here if you wanted to, because I bet you were looking for a smoothie. Maybe not. I don't know. But if you were, you know where to...
Over the next 6 weeks... Lewis will be recording your voices, and we will listen to your sounds evolve right before your very ears. Because women should sound like women, not
baby dolls who end everything in a question.
Let's make a statement.
Okay. So, speaking of policing women's voices, she just stopped her outside.
Yeah, and so, again, I really liked the movie, and this was just a thing that I think does not read so well to me now, 10 years or whatever years later. It does feel very policey. Like, you know, people aren't going to take you seriously, or maybe shouldn't take you seriously because of your vocal choices.
That being said, I was a logger for The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. Mm. So I listened to uncut footage 12 hours at a time in a graveyard shift. I don't recommend it. And I type what I hear so that you're logging for story editors, for the writers to make the show. And there was a season where there was a girl, I just prayed every week she was about to get voted off because
she really was up in here and sitting in a hot tub and just had like a high wiggle in her voice.
It's not her fault, but it was a lot and it was in my ears. And I had to type everything she said, which was mostly,
oh my, that's amazing. Oh, yeah, I love that.
So, yeah, I'm not policing her. I just was like, I could not leave her. It was my job to listen to her until she was voted off.
I am curious whether the job that you were doing exists in the same way today, because that feels like an absolutely perfect use of AI to log that.
Because think about it, like, that was a paid gig.
I'm sorry.
That's how I kept it.
I'm not saying it should go away. I'm just saying like that feels like very low hanging fruit.
Stop it.
I'm sorry. I'm not advocating for it that those jobs be replaced. I think it's fantastic that you got paid. I want people to get paid, but
I was, you know, helping writers who also weren't getting called writers. So the whole thing was, where's our union? Mm. But logging is a job that is not for the weak, but it's definitely for for people who need to be underpaid to survive living in LA for the first few years. So yes, it's definitely probably an AI job now, except they don't know what they're doing when they're not talking. Mm. And I watched a lot of non-talking footage. And then I would just make up what she was thinking. Which is why I was not cut out for that job.
Yeah. So I would say AIs right now are pretty good at being able to describe what is literally happening on screen. Is it going to be useful for the editor who's assembling stuff? Maybe not. And so you may still need actual human beings there to do that. But anyway, back to the discussion of like whispering in voices and sort of the choices people are making. I think we have ways of indicating on a script what volume it should be. We put things in uppercase when people are shouting. We will put parentheticals in there to give a sense of what that is. When someone has an overall vocal quality, I think you're right. Sometimes you do want to call it out if it's going to be something that other characters are going to remark upon, but you don't want to sort of box in your actor unnecessarily, and you still need to let them make their own choices.
Yeah, I wonder if that In the World girl's character is just baby voice girl. Like, she, maybe she's in it later. She had a character name, but... Yeah. That's usually how it's done, isn't it? So that you don't even get a choice. Like, the character is called Annoying Voice Girl.
I would like to talk now about Nimona, because as I watched this, I kept hearing your voice all over it. And my guess was that you recorded Scratch for her, for Lotto. Is that true?
Oh, that's funny. No, because we already had Chloe hired. So I'm trying to remember if we did Scratch. Gosh, because we did it during lockdown, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to remember how that all worked. But no, I don't remember. I don't remember. Some of these things we just block out.
Yeah.
But I was making My Year of Dicks and Nimona at the same time in this office, in this room during lockdown, while I was also slightly teaching first and second grade. So forgive me if I don't remember. But we definitely read it out loud and read it in the room and did all of that stuff. So that is probably what you're hearing too, is yes, acting it out.
She has an incredibly expressive voice. I would say next to sort of like Sarah Silverman's character in the Wreck-It movies, it's probably one of the biggest little girl voices I've seen, because like she's not always a little girl, of course. Mm-hmm. But she's really super, super expressive. Was it fun? Was it fun to write that character?
It was fun. It was, and also I was brought in at a time when it was like, we need to really dig into Nimona and get her voice out. I mean, you know, this IP has been around, and Nate is a part of it too. So this is a voice that was already on the page and in the creator, but being able to play around in that back and forth, and, you know, I'm not a girl. I'm not a little girl. I'm Nimona was just a fun place. And then also Riz was already cast too. So you knew the dynamic you could play there.
Yeah. So talk to us about like when you came on board and sort of what the brief was, what had changed. So this is based, I should say, this is available for anybody who wants to watch it on Netflix. You should absolutely see it. And it was one of the 5 Oscar nominated animated films this year. So congratulations on it. At what point were you coming on? And so there was obviously a graphic novel. It sounds like there was already a script, but you were still digging in on how to sort of surface the best out of her.
Yeah, well, it had been around for quite a bit before I came on board, because, you know, Patrick Osborne was working on it at Fox Animation. I know I was still working on Ralph Breaks the Internet, but part of me feels like I might have still been on Moana when it started. I'm not sure, but it's been around, you know, it was a long time coming. They had talked about me coming on earlier. Blue Sky is based in Connecticut, and I didn't think that I could go move out there and work on the movie. And that was why I had passed at that point. And then, you know, March came around and they were like, what if we just come to your house every day? And I met at that point, Nick and Troy were involved as the directors, and I met with them and we all hit it off. So they had had this rewrite that had gone well in the boards that they had had, and it was starting to work. And they, you know, I came in at a time where they had done so many, they had tried so many things that was kind of the hard part coming in to the story team so late. Even this beginning of, to talk about He's Perfect, she wasn't doing the opening narration. And that was one of the first things I was pitching, because you don't meet her for a while.
Yeah. She's the title character, and it seems like she has sidekick energy, mm-hmm. and yet she ends up becoming the central character in ways that are really unusual and feel like it's almost a commentary on how we treat, you know, secondary characters in animated films.
Yeah. And even the draft I had read before these reels where I came in, it had changed a bunch. They had really tried to figure this one out in many, many ways. And so even saying like, well, what if you hear her before you meet her? Like, we tried it. You know, we had to get through a lot of we tried it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to be really careful and confident when you're coming in that way of like, with all due respect, we haven't tried it. Like the we that includes me now. And let me see if I can show you a little what I mean. And even then, that takes time. That's a real double dutch of, I'll leave that whole area alone that I know my instincts, but we're not there yet to talk about it. And, but anyway, you know, the studio was, shut down while we were, still working on it. But as we kept working together, it was getting stronger, trying to figure out, I would say the story structure stayed the same, but we were moving around the parts of when do we know what we know and why and how, and that stuff got shifted around quite a bit. But being able to, you know, gleefully play with Nimona, luckily that was always encouraged. Everybody on this movie was so funny. And so once she was really sparkling, you know, there were a lot of like, I bet she'd say this. I bet she'd say this. But people got protective of Nimona, as they should, you know.
Yeah.
I had said something about her speaking in a different language at some point. And they were like, no, she's not. She doesn't know other languages. She's never really been anywhere else. And I'm like, oh, you know, you got this with Ralph Breaks the Internet too, where they were like, he can't wear glasses. He, like, his eyes won't deteriorate. He's a digital figure. And I was like, she's eating a churro. I don't know what to say. I'm confused.
The rules of your world are complicated. Yes. She seems to, like, you know animals that she's probably has not seen. Like, right. Has she seen a rhino in real life? Yeah. So,
But, you know, you've worked so hard to understand this world that doesn't exist, that when someone else comes in and points, you know, just says something like, never, like, just, you have to be like, all right, I will be like this too one day. I know it, bro. Be like, no, you can't turn off surge protect, like, just weird things that you get so mad about. You're like, that's fundamentally against the core of who she is. Like, that's where you get, and that's when you know you're really in it.
Hearing about the development process, it also strikes me that it helps to answer a question I had, which is that the film uses its time in unusual ways, and that, like, things that in other films would be like, okay, well, we need to figure out a way to do this. And okay, the next, you know, sequence will be about doing that. Instead, like, the next scene literally does that thing. Like, we have to clear my name. And then we literally in the next scene, we clear his name. And I liked it. It seems to jump past a lot of the normal sequence of describe the obstacle, attempt to overcome the obstacle. It uses its time really in an unusual way.
I don't know how to speak to that, because part of me feels like that's family animation a lot of times, mm-hmm. so that we're letting everyone in the whole wide world, which is the demographic, know what's going on. And so there is a lot of, how did we get here's? And, well, then what are we going to do's?
Oh, yeah. And so I was saying, like, I think that is a hallmark of family animation, is that you are talking about the thing you need to do and then how you're going to do it. And then you do the thing. And what's unusual at Nimona is they describe, like, oh, we need to do a thing. And then, like, suddenly they just do the thing. And so where I'd expected, like, okay, this will be in the next 10 minutes, it's like, oh, no, that was taken care of in the next minute, which was unusual. So I think that may be a consequence of discovering some parts of the story as you're going through it.
Yeah. Also, I think because they were new to each other, they were doing a lot of emotional processing mm-hmm. while talking about how did that just happen. So instead of needing to do it, they really did work it through each other. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. So everyone check that out. Next topic I'd like to dig into is about early drafts. And it occurs to me because we read the scripts of the Oscar nominated films. It's like, oh, well, that's perfect. Of course, that was kind of always that way. But of course, we're reading the very final draft. In some cases, we're reading stuff that really reflects the final edit rather than the actual script that went into production with. And I find it to be so educational to look at early drafts. One of the things that I was able to do when I was at USC is they had this big script library, and they would have the final shooting script, but they'd also have, like, earlier drafts. And it was so cool to see the stuff that had changed from the original idea to the final film. So I remember reading the Point Break script and loving it. So this is a James Cameron rewrite of it. And it's just great, but it's different. It's not the final film. And you see sort of, like, what that looked like on the page, and ideas that were important at one point that then got dropped are great. Also, doing WJ arbitrations, a lot of times I'm reading, you know, seven scripts back, and you see sort of what the initial instinct was versus what the final film was. And you see how much stuff changes over the course of it. I think it's really a good process for any screenwriter to see how much things really do change along the way.
They solidify in your brain so differently too when you look back. Cause I did that a little looking back here for you for prepping, and I was blown away by what I didn't remember. And that's just a good reminder to yourself of, you have told yourself a story that you have believed. I mean, thank you for your service on arbitration, honestly, but I don't know, man, what a job, what a hard thing to do, John, to go and read all those drafts and make these decisions.
Yeah, I enjoy it. So I will say yes most of the times when they call me about doing one of them, just because it's important. You want sort of to give people the credit that they deserve for the hard work they did. One thing you show having the notes here is about Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. Had you read a script for that early on? Had you read it before you saw the movie?
No, not before I saw the film. So this was, you know, I was like, oh, that USC film script library sounds cool. But I was in a software company in Austin, Texas with the internet. And the version that we had of that was trying to find people illegally uploading websites full of scripts. And the early Natural Born Killer script was one I remember finding and being like, look at this. It's so different than this film that I saw a billion times. Yeah. And you know, it's very Tarantino-y. And when you go in there, you're like, oh, it's very Tarantino-y. But now they still have up the 1990 Tarantino script, which you can compare to the 1993 Oliver Stone and other writers draft.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting is that then when you dive even further into people talking about it, because I only know internet rabbit holes about the script, yeah. but it came out of True Romance, which was also a rewrite of a script. But in True Romance, Natural Born Killers is the screenplay that Clarence is writing while they're like on a road trip. So that's kind of interesting. It's the facts of life of the spinoff series of the Tarantino universe.
So I read Natural Born Killers from the USC Script Library. Mm-hmm. And so I remember reading it. This would have been 1992. And it was the first script where I ever like read the whole thing and then went back and just like started reading again from page one. I was just blown away by it and just sort of how it sort of upended the conventions of what I expected a movie to do. The fact that it moved into sitcoms and other things that just had this. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the script so you can see what it was. It was just amazing and sort of blew my mind. Like, oh, this is the thing I could do on the page. It was incredible. And so then I ended up working for the producers of Natural Born Killers. I was their assistant and ended up writing the novelization of Natural Born Killers. So I had a full experience there.
That's cool. Did you go all the way back to this first one?
I tried to pull things that I thought were really interesting about the first one into the novelization. The novelization really does not resemble the final movie very much at all. Like Oprah gets killed in the novelization. So it's a lot of very different stuff happens in it. No one should read the novelization. Just don't. But, I was happy with the draft I wrote. I was not happy with the draft that got published. But weirdly, the novelization of Natural Born Killers became my comedy sample that helped me get my very first job writing a screenplay, which was How to Eat Fried Worms. Because naturally, the person who wrote Natural Born Killers novelization should write a charming children's film about a kid who eats worms.
Take it from the writer of My Year of Dicks. You can also write Moana. But the, you know, what's interesting about that first script is I remember it was smaller and it was, I feel like it was mostly the trial of Mickey and Mallory Knox.
Oh, yeah.
And that's so different than what you get in Natural Born Killers and such an Oliver Stone kind of film. That I think that original indie film that Tarantino had made would have also, in that Reservoir Dogs world, like, would have thrived.
Oh, 100%. It would have totally blown up. It was really just terrific. And so the Oliver Stone movie I like, it's just I really missed the movie that I couldn't see, which was the 1990 script, because that would have been special in its own way.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Moana earlier, and this was actually probably what got me thinking about seeing early drafts, because on an audio podcast, it's hard for us to compare pages from, you know, two different versions of Natural Born Killers. But what we can do is listen to two different songs and compare them. And so I had not realized until this recent car trip where we started like playing I Want songs for movies, is that How Far I'll Go, which I think is a fantastic I Want song from Moana, was the second version of the I Want song. And the original one was More. Mm-hmm. And let's play a sample from More.
I count the steps from one end of my island to the other. It's 100 steps from where I sleep to the sea. And when I say I've learned all there is to know, well, there's another little island lesson Grandma Tala shows me. I know where I am from the scent of the breeze, the ascent of the climb, from the tangle of the trees, from the angle of the mountain to the sand on our island shore. I've been here before. There's gotta be more. I know there's more. There's always more. Someday I'll be out on the sea and I'm gonna see more. Yes, there's gotta be more. I know there's more. There's always.
Great. So if I had not told you that this was from Moana, you probably would have figured it out. Like, she's talking about being on an island. She's talking about wanting to get beyond this island. It is the same general broad strokes idea, but it's not the same. It doesn't really serve the same function as the finished song does.
Yeah, boy, that song takes me back. It's like you just threw me in a time machine.
So you were working on this movie back when this was the I Want song.
I worked. I was like, how did this all happen? Because before there was this song, I would write in the script fake lyrics or poems or ideas of where this song might be before we had Lynn and the music team involved. And so More came out of right towards the end of my time on Moana. And I did get to work with Lynn a little bit about what this song could be. And, you know, we'd gone back and forth in emails and in person. And More came out of that.
I don't think I ever talked about this. Did I ever come into the room with you when you were working on Moana? Because I came into a room for like an afternoon on Moana, but you may not have been on the project at that point.
I think you might have walked in as my door closed. Yeah. It was a real all hands moment when, when, you know, you change the writer. It is easier than anything else. We are on contracts. So, yeah, I think I did not meet with you. I did sit with Michael Arndt. So if you were around any time around Michael, that was around that time.
I literally came in one afternoon. My pencil never touched anything. I saw a bunch of artwork on the walls. What I saw is like, they didn't show me any clips. They just showed me sort of like all the art on the walls and talked me through the story. I'm like, oh boy, this isn't going to work. And, I was wrong. It worked really, really well. Cause it was only like a year out from the movie. I'm like, I don't know what you guys are doing here. And, they pulled it out. But in the process of figuring new stuff out, let's compare what we just listened to more. Let's listen to the I Want song that's actually in the movie. So this is How Far I'll Go.
I've been staring at the edge of the water long as I can remember, never really knowing why. I wish I could be the perfect daughter, but I come back to the water, no matter how hard I try. Every turn I take, every trail I track, every path I make, every road leads back to the place I know, where I cannot go, where I long to be. See the light with the side to see, it calls me, and no one knows.
So what we've done here is we've flipped the ideas around. So in More, she's sort of complaining about how stuck she feels on this island and wouldn't be great to be out there. In this version, she's saying, my island is fantastic. I love everybody here, but I'm still pulled to go and leave. And so there's a tension there that's very different. Like the brief of what, you know, we're supposed to understand about her is so different.
Yeah, part of that is, gosh, okay. So there's just Moana's journey changed quite a bit also. And, you know, at one point her family was lost at sea, so she was going to have to go and get them. Mm. And so the want had to change each time. But you had at the base of a problem with Moana is her island is wonderful and her life is great. And that wasn't something that was really supposed to change. You know, we had gone to these islands and interviewed young women of Moana's age, and they often said that they wanted to be pilots or missionaries or people who would leave their island but then have to come home, need to come home and want to come home. And and so that was, you couldn't have a want that was also, I'll just say, the problem with wanting more is you get that at the end of Act One.
Yeah.
And then and then you did it. Here we are. Here is More. So it's interesting in How Far I'll Go. You'll hear that every trail I track, everything, like there's parts of More that do end up in How Far I'll Go.
Yeah, let's listen to that. Here's a little clip of that.
There's more. There's always more. My father, the chief, says don't cross the reef, but oh, every turn I take, every trail I track, every path I make, every road leads back to the sea. I am standing at the edge of the sea.
Yeah, so that musical idea made it back through into the final song.
Yeah, and it was also, I remember in the boards, it was like, that part works. Like, there she is. And that's the thing. That's the feeling and the movement. So I'm not surprised that got stuck and stayed throughout the next version.
Comparing these two things, it's just a good reminder that, like, be it in our scripts or in this case, the songs, you recognize that you went in with a specific idea. Like, this is how we get from this place to this place. This is who the character is. And sometimes it's only when you sort of get through the draft, you realize like, oh, okay, that was not actually the story, or that's not actually the motivation. That's not the best way to do this. You discover something by kind of playing through it, and all the outlines you want to make, all the thinking you can do is not as helpful as actually trying it and seeing what works. And that's one of the huge advantages of animation, is that you actually get to see like, okay, does this work? You have these intermediate steps where you get to see a thing. Broadway musicals are the same thing, where you have readings, you have workshops, you stage it, you're changing it every night, and you get to see what actually works. Our features on television, our live action features of television, we don't get those opportunities. We go in, we shoot a thing once, we spend a long time in the editing room trying to make it work, but there's no chance to make big changes to things.
You're also sort of working on two different versions of the story at the same time, because you'd have a scene that then would just get lifted and be like, actually, I can turn that into a song and save you and save you 5 minutes of screen time with a 3 minute song. As a writer, you're like, these are all just workable ideas. These are just thoughts. The script is thoughts a lot of times, because even, you know, you're not recording what they're going to say for a very long time. So that won't be the same either, because as soon as you're in front of them and they're trying every line a few different ways, and then you're improvising, and you're really, it is a ball you're playing with a lot of times. But you know, it's your ball. Like, it's very hard not to feel like, that's my ball. But it's not, because you hit it over the net quite a few times. There's a bunch of teams. I'll keep metaphoring. Yeah. I don't care.
100%. Weirdly, a lot of the animation I've done has been stop motion animation, which is kind of the exception, where like we get to shoot a thing once, and like, so you pre-record, you shoot a thing once, you kind of can't change a lot. It's more like live action. And I've found it frustrating to try to do traditional animation, because I will deliver a script like, here's the script, go for it. And then I will get these boards back and it's like, wait, what are you doing there? Like, that's not the script at all. Like, you've just chosen a completely different thing to animate that's not actually useful for my script. And that's John August struggling with how traditional animation is done.
It's not for the weak.
It's not for the weak. I was compared sort of animation to Broadway musicals. And I'm thinking back to when we were doing the Big Fish musical, we did our out-of-town tryout in Chicago. And we had a really rough time because we were trying to make big changes. But every night, we had to put on a show that people could actually watch and make sense. And so we would introduce stuff in sort of blocks and pieces so that it could all still fit together every night. But we still were changing a lot. We were adding new songs. We were moving stuff. We were cutting stuff. And one of the things we realized is that we did not have an I Want song for Will that worked. And so the challenge I put for Andrew was like, Andrew Lippa, you need to write an I Want song for Will. Let's talk about what's in it. Let's talk about what ideas there are. And so I remember being in the basement of the Oriental Theater, and he played me the song, which became Stranger, which was the big I Want song for Will. And it was perfect. It was wonderful. And we couldn't do anything with it. There was no way to stick it into the show. And so we couldn't tell the company like that this new song existed until we closed in Chicago, went back to New York. We're in the workshop again, and we could sort of introduce this new song, which transformed big parts of the show. And I just remember, like, you know, tears out there, like, oh my God, we did it. We actually made this thing happen. But there was no way to actually make that fix live until we could get back into a safe place to insert it. It was such a different experience than anything I would have had doing features.
You know, and that's even in Moana, I think it was where to put that want song, because it can come too late and now she's complaining, you know, or it's too early and you were like, why? What is she even talking about? I don't agree. Like, you have to agree with their want, and it has to be like, me too. That's exactly what I want for you. I had pulled up all the stuff to around the time that Moore was written to sort of remember the brain that we were in. We were very much like, okay, look, we know there's like 9 things the song has to do, right? Poor Lynn. There are 9 things the song has to do. And at one point, there's this document that was sent to him that was like, here's just possible titles. This is my favorite. I was like, this is amusing as a writer. I think it's alchemy. People who are able to write songs that they hear music, or even how they, like, I felt so embarrassed every time I knew someone was reading one of these fake song poems I was trying to do. Like, I'm in a coffee shop on a stage. But we sent the following. Here's just some possible titles. Why? But anyway, set sail. I'll find my way. I know my way. I learned too well. Why not now? If not now, when? To sail is life. I want to sail. The next step, the biggest step. I hear you. My life's at sea. My dream to sail. The far horizon. Beyond the reef. The endless beyond. Beyond the edge of nowhere. There's somewhere there past nowhere. I am Moana, daughter of the sea. My life, my ocean. A different voice. A different song. A different rhythm.
So some of those are terrible, but some of those actually totally make sense. You could completely imagine some of those things being that I Want song.
Sure.
I don't remember. So I saw this in France. When I saw it, it was Vaiana. She wasn't Moana. I know why, because Moana was the porn star in Italy, I think, and then also a trademark in other places. So they had in Europe, it's just Vaiana. Mm-hmm. It always was Vaiana. My question is, I don't remember, is this the second song? Because classically, the I Want song in an anime musical is the second song. There's a Welcome to the World song that sets up the whole universe. And then this is the second song. Is it the second song?
I don't think it is, because you've got We Know the Way and Where You Are. Let's see. Track listing, it's number 4, but that's, I think, because of the opening sound.
Yeah, score,
yeah,
stuff.
Score stuff. So it might be how far I'll Go is after Where You Are. So yeah, but that's the thing, right? So Where You Are is, this is the perfect world song. And now, and that's it. Like, We Know the Way used to always open. It was the first song they wrote as a team. It was so great. We were like, this is it. And yeah, so it was considered, this is how the movie has to open, which then your third song would be a Want song, which feels a little late.
It does feel a little bit late.
She also used to sing a song before that of who Maui was. So there was a whole Maui song too.
No, that's not going to work.
It was a lot.
Yeah, I could have come into the room and said, it's not going to work.
It was like an act one break. Like, she was singing like, I've got to go. I've got to find Maui. I hope my dad doesn't mind. I hope he's not mad at me. I've got to get this right. I think this is who I am, and I won't know if I don't go see it, was kind of that Want song. So it was a little like, I want to know if this feeling inside me is okay to have.
Which is a good thought. I mean, that actually holds through into How Far I'll Go, mm-hmm. Which is like, I feel this tension because I love everything here, and yet I'm completely drawn out there. I want to be a good daughter, and yet I feel like I can't be. Those are real things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment about the article by Mark Harris called How Bad Can It Get for Hollywood? Really looking at the future threat of YouTube and TikTok, coming down to the idea that young Americans aren't thinking about movies and televisions in the same way. And so the industry that we've built to entertain people is in danger of being supplanted by a video that they're watching that is not created by studios and, of course, union writers. What did you take from this?
I feel like, here's this article again. I don't know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is that okay to say?
I would generally agree with you. Yeah. Like, you're safe to predict doom and gloom every year.
Mm-hmm. But in its TV and film, like, there's another one going on, right? Video games. It's all the doom and gloom of all the things. It's all supposed to be really bad. I feel like I'm always in the whatever is the version, wherever they're complaining that it's over and is dead is where I'm employed. That seems to be.
Always good.
And then they're like, you're not getting employed well over here. This is where the people are really employed. So I have, I don't really read these because I don't take them into my, and my husband is someone who will be like, you know, your job's replaced. And I just don't, like, even this article that you linked, I kind of read with one eye squinting because I don't want it to get in my heart or my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's always sort of an existential threat, which is basically that people are just going to stop watching the stuff that we're making. And because people have a certain number of hours in the day, they're going to spend those hours doing things that are not movies or television. And so the prediction that, like, you know, theatrical movies will fail, no one will go to the movie theaters anymore. Well, is attendance down? Sure. But there's still something kind of great about being in a public space with people all watching the same things. And even my teenage daughter does like doing that at times. Mm-hmm. I mean, she loves TikTok. She loves YouTube. But there's something great about sort of the event of everyone staring at the same screen watching a thing. There's something appealing about television events that sort of get everyone, you know, watching the same thing and talking about the same thing. There's reasons why that works and will probably continue to work. And yet I think we do need to be mindful that there's new threats pulling at people's attention, and that attention could make it harder for some of the economics of our business to work.
Yeah. I mean, you've really said it. Like, we can all like a TikTok, but we can't all go watch a TikTok and talk about it together and go on a date to TikTok, right? So the idea of there's still communal events, they're still bringing us together. And if they're the kinds of things that people are talking about, you got to go do the thing to see the thing to be able to talk about it too. But that being said, I was at a friend's house recently where they just had on the television two things from YouTube. One was a screensaver that they just had on. Yeah. And every once in a while, the neon sign in the image would blink and they'd all be like, yay. And then and they also watch like marble runs where it's like elaborate. And I said, and I just said, why do we work so hard? Like, there was someone in the house was also in the industry. I was like, they both are. I was like, Why do we work so hard? You guys just sit here and watch marble runs. And they're like, look at it go. Yay. So there's that element to what we make, too, of can you shut off your head and have fun? And I think that's what this, you know, the Eras Tour is proving, like, oh, my gosh, we just want Barbie. You know, let's go have fun. They certainly tried to make Oppenheimer seem like a rollicking good time. Let's go out and have fun. And it worked because people were ready to do that.
We have some listener questions here that are perfect for Pamela Rubin, our guest today. So, Drew, start us off.
Larkin, Virginia writes, recently I've been doing some rewrites for a series pilot. And as I've been going back, I've been considering how the show may be if it was animation instead of live action. Just how different is writing animation compared to live action? Do you still follow the formula in terms of writing on the page? And how have things changed with writing for animation now in the after days of the strike? I feel like there are more eyes on both the WGA in both a good way and a bad way, and more awareness towards TAG in general.
We've talked a lot about for writing animation, even in this episode. If you actually look at a script for an animated series and a live action series, they're not different. Animated like half hours, like a Simpsons, is double spaced in ways, but otherwise it's the same kind of formatting all throughout.
Yeah, I didn't even think that this was a format question because it's the formulas. You're writing scripts. You're writing scripts. You're telling stories. They're the same. Your budget is different. Maybe, maybe they're pretty expensive too. And the character talking might be a cat. So that's different. But no, you don't write it differently. You ask yourself, does it need to be animated? Yeah. And that's what's different mostly.
Yeah. There's an animated series that I may be doing here soon. And you're figuring out like how you're going to do it. Because there's, you know, when you say animation, there's 15 different things and ways that you could be doing an animated series. And they have different costs and different requirements. But the actual script, the stuff that you're writing, that's not going to change that much. It's really, that feels the same between live action and animation. Rarely do you see a script that was written for live action that you could just immediately take and then just turn into animation. That there's, you're going to make some different choices just based on how audiences see things, how stuff fits together, how transitions work. You tend to write knowing something is going to be animated or not animated. But it's, if you're a person who can write live action, you're a person who can write animation and vice versa. Mm-hmm. The difference in this and challenges can be is that writing something how you guys were writing Moana was a much more iterative process than what a writer would normally encounter. And that's something you have to deal with. And the sort of being good with, you said sort of like, here's a bundle of ideas that you know are going to change. Mm-hmm. That's a very different experience.
Yeah. You know, I would say it still happens in live action too. And when it is, you're still like, oh, iterative. It's just the word that I hear a lot now.
Yeah.
But yes, in animation, it is kind of the point of it. And particularly if you're coming around during development before the thing is in actual production, which then is still in reels. You're never really shooting the thing. You're never shooting it. That's it, John.
That's the thing. You're never shooting it and you're never really in post. It's all kind of one blurry thing. So there's development, which is before you have, I guess there can still be storyboard artists in that time, but it's before you have this expectation of like, we're really making this thing. But even when they say that they're really making the thing, they may not be making the thing. Nimona, it sounds like they were kind of making the thing and then decided they weren't making the thing. And then luckily someone else said, sure, we'll make the thing.
I mean, think of scenes that we made and finished in Ralph Breaks the Internet, you know, that were done in animation for the most part and then got cut.
Yeah.
So that's that. So then you're like, post-credit sequence. Yay. We'll still use it. Yeah, it's never being shot.
We had Jennifer Lee on to talk about Frozen and like, you know, they were way down the road in a lot of stuff and they made giant changes. And so there are sequences that they couldn't kind of go back through and completely redo that are just, they're not quite the same movie, and yet you roll with it because you roll with it. But like, I think it was like the Abominable Snowman sequence. It's like, it's not kind of the same movie. Those aren't kind of the same characters, and yet it works because it needs to work. And they did not have the time to go back through and completely change that the way they would want to change that, so that you're always making those choices. And that way, it feels more like traditional film and TV, where you shot a thing, you got to make it work in the editing room.
Yeah, and sometimes you're just so close that you really are the only one who's noticing. You know, in its whole, people are like, yay, you know. But this question of how have things changed with writing for animation now in the after days of the strike? Nothing. But
nothing. Here's what I would say is different. It's like one of the best things about the strike for me were the days that I was at generally Warner Brothers and would see a zillion tagged the Animation Guild folks out there on picket line with us. And I know you've pushed hard for improving conditions for writers working under tag contracts. And I think there was a sense of WGA versus tag, and that's a ridiculous dichotomy. The case is you want things to be WGA and tag, because tag is not just folks who are writing animation, but it's all the other folks who are working in animation. So it's the storyboard artists and other crucial people in animation. And we would love to see movies and TV shows that have WGA writers who have the full protections and credits and residuals for the writing that they're doing. And those projects have full tag union members getting everything else done. We want union animation.
Yes, or union parity, right? That putting it under tag doesn't mean I don't have the same kind of protections and residuals that I would have had if you had made it WGA. And since tag can't free their writers, then that's what needs to happen within tag. But not just writers. Like, there are many, many members of tag who are not being treated appropriately, which is why tag might go on strike. It is nice that it is less thinking that, I thought everybody was WGA, or, I had no idea that most of you were being forced to work without a union at all, depending on the studio. And I think just also an awareness of what a union does. But I think tag still has a long way to go for people to understand and respect its union members.
Yeah. So obviously those negotiations are starting right now. So tag is part of a larger IATSE, but tag also has its own contracts it negotiates. It's complicated, but we need to be mindful of it and just never pretend that writing animation is lesser than writing live action.
That's right. The things we were on strike for in the WGA are what does happen in tag now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, you know, there's a whole lot of like AI is already in tag. You know what I mean? Like it's happening there. I've seen it. And a lot of these protections that we were on strike about are because we know it can happen because it does happen to animation.
Well, yeah. Minimum staff size, for an example. We would talk to tag animation writers, showrunners, who basically could not hire any writing staff. And so we're basically having to do everything themselves. That's, you know, a danger you want to avoid in live action so that you don't have showrunners just melting down because they don't have the writing support they need.
Mm-hmm. As
one of many for instances. Let's do our one cool things. I'm so excited to see what you have for your one cool thing.
Oh, well, I know you lived in Paris for some time. And, you know, as an adult, you can do things that you didn't get to do in high school, like learn French. I, you know, once I started going to the Annecy Animation Festival in France, I was like, I want to keep coming back here, but I want to know more French every time. Yeah. So there's this place called Cuckoo. Cuckoo French classes are based in Los Angeles and New York, where a lot of writers live. Cuckoo has two locations in LA, I think Silver Lake, and their new one is in Culver City, but they're also online. This is a way to learn French that has a lot of, like, I don't know, for me, I've always done it online, although there's one down the street, but we get together, we are conversing, we are learning, and they have all different fun ways to practice your French. They also send out newsletters for here are some French rom-coms to watch. And here's, they have little classes in like poetry, book reading, wine, flower arrangement. Like it is sort of, what if learning another language was a fun community as opposed to something you did alone and got confused about?
So going beyond just like, you know, talking to Duolingo every day and making that little green owl happy.
See, because Duolingo is a slot machine. Duolingo is the Vegas of language learning. And I don't like, I think it's pretty cool to like jam it in there. And the Pimsleur method has its own way, but those are all lonely. Those are lonely tasks. So I invite you to the Cuckoo community. There's private lessons, there's group classes, there's workshops and events. And then you can walk down to your little French location and hang out and have a baguette. It's fun.
That's awesome. It's fun. My one cool thing is a video I saw this past week by David Friedman, and he was looking at the Fox sitcom Till Death, which I remember sort of as a title, but I never saw a single frame of that sitcom. So the video talks through how the fact that Till Death made it to four seasons, not because anybody was watching it, but because Sony, who was making the show, sort of made a deal with Fox to say, like, we'll give it to you kind of for free. They just wanted to hit 100 episodes so they could hit syndication. And so in that fourth season, they had a new showrunner. And because no one was watching, they could just make some really weird, wild swings. And so characters became aware that they were on a sitcom. They just did some things you shouldn't be able to do in a sitcom that were kind of fun and interesting. I don't need to go back and watch the sitcom, but I did enjoy sort of like Friedman's sort of like exploration of like how strange the sitcom got because it was just allowed to get so strange. The other thing I thought was interesting was a blog post Friedman did about sort of how he constructed it, because this was like 80 hours of video to watch. He didn't want to watch the whole sitcom. So he built a script that went through and figured out which cast members were in which things, because they kept changing out cast members, and sort of built a Excel spreadsheet that sort of showed where the changes were so he could just look at those moments and not have to watch the whole thing, which was just very smart and felt very much like how I would do it. So I enjoyed the video and sort of his explanation behind the scenes. That is our show for this week. Scriptness is produced by Drew Marquardt. It's edited by Matthew Cilelli. Our outro this week is by Vincent DeVito. If you have an outro, you can send us a link to ask at johnaugust.com. That's also the place where you can send questions. You'll find the show notes to this episode and all episodes at johnaugust.com. That's also where you find transcripts and sign up for our weekly newsletter called Interesting, which has lots of links to things about writing. We have t-shirts and hoodies. They're great. You'll find them at Cotton Bureau. You can sign up to become a premium member at scriptos.net, where you get all the back episodes and bonus segments like the one Pamela and I are about to talk through on the Oscars and attending the Oscars and how fun the Oscars are. But that couldn't be as much fun as having Pamela on again as a co-host here. An absolute delight getting to chat with you about these things.
So much fun. I can't wait to come back again. I hope you invite me. Thank you.
We will. And also remind us where we can find you, because you have your other podcast as well. So talk through.
Oh, yeah.
How do we find you?
Now this is one of mine. I'll take it. Co-host a podcast called Listen to Sassy, where we go through every issue of the beloved 90s magazine that you can find all about at Listen to Sassy. Is it .com or .net? Hold on. It's .com. Of course it is. Listen to sassy.com. And I don't go to Twitter. So you can find
me. I stopped Twitter too. Yeah.
You can find me at Instagram at Pamela Ribbon. But yeah, Listen to Sassy is a great way to hear more about what it's like to use from the years when you talked like this.
Perfect.
You know what also? And if you do want to watch My Year of Dicks, it's at myyearofdicks.com.
I love it. And everyone should watch it. It's so, so good. Oh, and when people will tell me like, Pamela Ribbon was on the show and I finally watched My Year of Dicks. It was really good. I'm like, yes, I told you that last summer.
Yeah, you guys were very early supporters and I thank you. I don't know that we would segue be getting to the Oscars without you. So thank you so much.
Hurrah.